From the outside, there was no evidence of damage or repair. Part of the heat shield hung below the cutter's nose, like a great shovel blade, exposing the control room blister, windows, and the snout of the cutter's main armament, a laser cannon. In battle, the cutter's first duty was to make observations and reports. Sometimes she'd try to sneak in on a torpedo run on a blinded enemy warship. Against moaty ships with no field, that cannon would be more than enough. Cargill inspected the cutter's weapons with more than usual thoroughness. Already he feared the moaties. In this, he was almost alone. But he would not be so forever. The second alien ship was larger than the first, but estimates of its mass had a high finagle factor, depending on the acceleration, known, fuel consumption, deduced from drive temperature, operating temperature, deduced from the radiation spectrum, whose peak was in the soft X-ray region, and efficiency. Pure guesswork. When it was all folded together, the mass seemed much too small, about right for a three-man ship. "But they aren't men," Renner pointed out. "Four Modis weigh as much as two men, but they don't need as much room. We don't know what they're carrying for equipment or armament or shielding. Thin walls don't seem to scare them, and that lets them build bigger cabins." "All right," Rod cut him off. "If you don't know, just say so." "I don't know." "Thank you," Rod said patiently. "Is there anything you are sure of?"
"Oddly enough, there is, sir. Acceleration. It's been constant to three significant figures since we spotted the ship."
"Now that's odd," Renner said. "Normally you fool with the drive to keep it running at peak. You correct minor errors in course, and if you leave it alone, there's still variation. To keep the acceleration that constant, they must be constantly fiddling with it." Rod rubbed the bridge of his nose. "It's a signal. They're telling us exactly where they're going."
"Yes, sir. Right here. They're saying to wait for them."
Renner wore that strange, fierce grin. "Oh, we know something else, Captain. The ship's cross-sectional profile has decreased since we sighted it. Probably they've ditched some fuel tanks."
"How did you get that? Don't you have to have the target transit the sun?"
"Usually, yes. Here it blocks the coal sack. There's enough light bouncing off the coal sack to give us a good estimate of that ship's cross-sectional area." "Haven't you noticed the colors in the coal sack, Captain?"
"No." Blaine rubbed at his nose again. "Throwaway fuel tanks doesn't make them sound like a warship, does it? But it's no guarantee. All it really tells us is that they're in a hurry."
Staley and Buckman occupied the rear seats in the cutter's triangular control cabin. As the cutter pulled away at 1G, Staley watched MacArthur's field close behind them. Against the black of the coal sack, the battlecruiser seemed to go invisible. There was nothing to look at but the sky. Half that sky was coal sack, starless except for a hot pink point several degrees in from the edge. It was as if the universe ended here, like a wall, Horst thought.
"Look at it," said Buckman, and Horst jumped. "There are people on New Scotland who call it the face of God. Superstitious idiots."
"Right," said Horst. "Superstitions were silly. From here it doesn't look at all like a man, and it's 10 times as magnificent. I wish my sister's husband could see it. He belongs to the Church of Him." Horst nodded in the semi-darkness. From any of the known human worlds, the coal sack was a black hole in the sky. One would expect it to be black here. But now that Horst's eyes were adjusting, he saw traces of red glowing within the coal sack. Now the nebular material showed like layer after layer of gauzy curtains, or like blood spreading in water. The longer he looked, the deeper he could see into it. Eddies and whorls and flow patterns showed light-years deep in the vacuum-thin dust and gas. "Imagine me stuck with a hymnist for a brother-in-law. I've tried to educate the fool," Buckman said energetically, "but he just won't listen."
"I don't think I've ever seen a more beautiful sky. Dr. Buckman, is all that light coming from Murkison's eye?" Doesn't seem possible, does it? We've tried to find other sources, fluorescence, UV stars deep in the dust like that. If there were masses in there, we'd have found them with mass indicators. Staley, it's not that unlikely. The eye isn't that far from the coal sack.
A couple of light years.
Well, what of it? Light travels farther than that, given a free path. Buckman's teeth glowed in the faint, multicolored light of the control panel. Murchison lost a golden opportunity by not studying the coal sack when he had the chance.
Of course he was on the wrong side of the eye, and he probably didn't venture very far from the breakout point.
And it's our luck, Staley. There's never been an opportunity like this. A thick interstellar mass, and a red supergiant right at the edge for illumination. Look. Look along my arm, Staley, to where the currents flow toward that eddy. Like a whirlpool, isn't it? If your captain would stop twiddling his thumbs and give me access to the ship's computer, I could prove that that eddy is a protostar in the process of condensation. Or that it isn't.
Buckman had a temporary rank higher than Staley's, but he was a civilian. In any case, he shouldn't be talking about the captain that way. We do use the computer for other things, Dr. Buckman.
Buckman let go of Staley's arm.
Too damned many.
His eyes seemed lost. His soul was lost in that enormous veil of red-lit darkness. We may not need it, though. The Motis must have been observing the coal sack for all their history. Hundreds of years. Maybe thousands. Especially if they've developed some such pseudoscience as astrology. If we can talk to them. He trailed off.
Staley said, "We wondered why you were so eager to come along."
"What?
Do you mean jaunting off with you to see this rock?"
"Staley, I don't care what the Moti was using it for. I want to know why the Trojan points are so crowded."
"You think there'll be clues?"
"Maybe, in the composition of the rock. We can hope so."
"I may be able to help you there," Staley said slowly. "Sauron, my home, has an asteroid belt and mining industries. I learned something about rock mining from my uncles. Thought I might be a miner myself once."
He stopped abruptly, expecting Buckman to bring up an unpleasant subject. Buckman said, "I wonder what the captain expects to find there."
"He told me that." "We know just one thing about that rock," said Staley. "A Moti was interested in it. When we know why, we'll know something about Motis."
"Not very much," Buckman growled.
Staley relaxed. Either Buckman didn't know why Sauron was infamous, or...
no.
Tactful? Buckman?
Not hardly.
The Moti pup was born 5 hours after MacArthur's cutter left for the asteroid. The birth was remarkably dog-like, considering the mother's distant relationship to dogs, and there was only the one pup, about the size of a rat. The lounge was very popular that day, as crew and officers and scientists, and even the chaplain, found an excuse to drop by.
"Look how much smaller the lower left arm is," said Sally. "We were right, Jonathan. The little ones are derived from the big Motis."
Someone thought of leading the large Moti down to the lounge. She did not seem the least interested in the new miniature Moti, but she did make sounds at the others. One of them dug Horace Berry's watch out from under a pillow and gave it to her. Rod watched the activities around the Moti pup when he could. It seemed very highly developed for a newborn. Within hours of its birth it was nibbling at cabbages, and it seemed able to walk, although the mother usually carried it with one set of arms. She moved rapidly, and was hardly hampered by it at all. Meanwhile, the Moti ship drew nearer, and if there was any change in its acceleration, it was too small for MacArthur to detect. "They'll be here in 70 hours, Rod told Cargill via laser message. "I want you back in 60. Don't let Buckman start anything he can't finish within the time limit. If you contact aliens, tell me fast, and don't try to talk to them unless there's no way out."
"Aye, aye, Skipper."
"Not my orders, Jack.
Kutyasov's.
He's not happy about this excursion. Just look that rock over and get back."
The rock was 30 million kilometers distant from MacArthur, about a 25-hour trip each way at 1G. 4 gravities would cut that in half. Not enough, Staley thought, to make it worthwhile putting up with 4 Gs.
"But we could go at 1.5G, sir," he suggested to Cargill. "Not only would the trip be faster, but we'd get tired faster. We wouldn't move around so much. The cutter wouldn't seem so crowded."
"That's brilliant," Cargill said warmly. "A brilliant suggestion, Mr. Staley."
"Then we'll do it?"
"We will not."
"But why not, sir?"
"Because I don't like plus Gs. Because it uses fuel, and if we use too much, MacArthur may have to dive into the gas giant to get us home. Never waste fuel, Mr. Staley. You may want it someday. And besides, it's a nitwit idea."
"Yes, sir."
"Nitwit ideas are for emergencies. You use them when you've got nothing else to try. If they work, they go in the book. Otherwise, you follow the book, which is largely a collection of nitwit ideas that worked." Cargill smiled at Staley's puzzled look. "Let me tell you about the one I got in the book." For a midshipman, it was always school time. Staley would hold higher ranks than this one, if he had the ability, and if he lived. Cargill finished his story and looked at the time. "Get some sleep, Staley. You'll have the con after turnover." From a distance, the asteroid looked dark, rough, and porous. It rotated once in 31 hours. Oddly slow, according to Buckman. There was no sign of activity, no motion, no radiation, no anomalous neutrino flux. Horst Staley searched for temperature variations, but there were none.
"I think that confirms it," he reported.
"The place must be empty. A life form that evolved on Mote Prime would need heat, wouldn't it, sir?"
"Yes."
The cutter moved in. Stippling, which had made the rock look porous at a distance, became pox, then gaping holes of random size. Meteors, obviously. But so many?
"I told you the Trojan points were crowded," Buckman said happily. "Probably the asteroid passes through the thick of the Trojan cluster regularly. Only give me a close-up of that big pock there, Cargill."
2 powers higher, and the screen was half-filled by a black pit. Smaller pits showed around it.
"No sign of a crater rim," Cargill said.
"Noticed that, did you? Damn thing's hollow. That's why the density is so low. Well, it's not inhabited now, but it must have been once. They even went to the trouble of giving it a comfortable rotation."
Buckman turned.
"Cargill, we'll want to search through that thing."
"Yes, but not you. A Navy crew will board the rock."
"This is my field of competence, damn it."
"Your safety's mine, Doctor. Lafferty, take us around the rock."
The back of the asteroid was one enormous cup-shaped crater.
"Pocked with little craters. But they are craters, not holes," said Cargill.
"Doctor, what do you make of that?"
"I can't imagine. Not if it's a natural formation."
"It was moved," Staley exclaimed.
"Oddly enough, just what I was thinking," Cargill said.
"The asteroid was moved using thermonuclear devices, exploding the bombs progressively in the same crater to channel the blast. It's been done before. Get me a radiation reading, midshipman."
"Aye, aye, sir."
He left and returned in a minute. "Nothing, sir. It's cold."
"Really?"
Cargill went to check that for himself. When he finished, he looked at his instruments and frowned.
"Cold as a pirate's heart.
If they used bombs, they must have been goddamn clean. That shouldn't surprise me." The cutter circled farther around the flying mountain.
"That could be an airlock. There."
Staley pointed at a raised cap of stone surrounded by an archery target in faded orange paint.
"Right. But I doubt if we'd get it open. We'll go in through one of the meteor holes. Still, we'll look it over. Lafferty, take us in."
In their reports, they called it Beehive Asteroid. The rock was all many-sided chambers without floors linked by channels too small for men, all choked with dried asymmetrical mummies. Whatever miracles the builders had made, artificial gravity was not one of them. The corridors went in all directions. The larger chambers and storage rooms were studded everywhere with knobs for handholds, anchor points for lines, storage niches. The mummies floated everywhere, thin and dried, with gaping mouths. They varied from a meter to a meter and a half in height. Staley chose several and sent them back to the cutter. There was machinery, too, all incomprehensible to Staley and his men, all frozen fast by vacuum cementing. Staley had one of the smaller machines torn from the wall. He chose it for strangeness, not potential use. None of the machines was complete.
"No metal," Staley reported. "Stone flywheels and things that look like they might be integrated circuits, ceramics with impurities, that kind of thing. But very little metal, sir."
They moved on at random. Eventually, they reached a central chamber. It was gigantic, and so was the machine that dominated it. Cables that might have been power superconductors led from the wreck, convincing Staley that this was the asteroid's power source. But it showed no trace of radiation. They worked through narrow passages between incomprehensible blocks of stone and found a large, metallic box.
"Cut into that," Staley ordered. Lafferty used his cutting laser. They stood around watching the narrow green beam do nothing to the silvery casing. Staley wondered, where was the energy going? Could they be pumping power into it somehow? Warmth on his face hinted at the answer. He took a thermometer reading. The casing was just less than red hot all over. When Lafferty turned off the laser, the casing cooled rapidly, but it maintained the same temperature at every point. A superconductor of heat. Staley whistled into his suit mic and wondered if he could find a smaller sample. Then he tried using pliers on the casing, and it bent like tin. A strip came away in the pliers. They tore sheets off with their gauntleted hands. It was impossible to map the beehive with its tight, curving corridors. It was hard to tell where they were, but they marked their paths as they went and used proton beam instruments to measure distances through walls. The corridor walls were eggshell thin throughout the interior. They were not much thicker outside. Beehive asteroid could not have been a safe place to live. But the wall beneath the crater was many meters thick. Radiation, Staley thought. There must have been residual radiation. Otherwise, they would have carved this wall out the way they did all the others to make room for themselves. There must have been a wild population explosion here. And then something killed them all off. And now there was no radiation at all. How long ago did it all happen? The place was covered with small meteor holes, scores of holes in the walls. How long? Staley looked speculatively at the small, heavy, moaty artifact Lafferty and Saul were manhandling through the corridor. Vacuum cementing, and the wandering of elementary particles across an interface. That might tell MacArthur's civilian scientists just how long Beehive Asteroid had been abandoned. But already he knew one thing. It was old. 19. Channel 2's popularity. Chaplain David Hardy watched the miniatures only through the intercom because that way he wasn't involved in the endless speculations on what motis were. It was a question of scientific interest to Horvath and his people, but to Chaplain Hardy, there was more than intellectual curiosity at stake. It was his job to determine if motis were human. Horvath's scientists only wondered if they were intelligent. The one question preceded the other, of course. It was unlikely that God had created beings with souls and no intelligence, but it was quite possible that he had created intelligent beings with no souls, or beings whose salvation was brought about by ways entirely different from those of mankind. They might even be a form of angel, although an unlikelier-looking set of angels would be hard to imagine. Hardy grinned at the thought and went back to his study of the miniatures.
The big Moti was asleep. The miniatures weren't doing anything interesting at the moment either. It wasn't necessary for Hardy to watch them continuously. Everything was holographed anyway, and as MacArthur's linguist, Hardy would be informed if anything happened. He was already certain the miniatures were neither intelligent nor human. He sighed deeply. "What is man that thou art mindful of him, O Lord? And why is it my problem to know what place Motis have in thy plan?" Well, that at least was straightforward. Second-guessing God is an old, old game. On paper, he was the best man for the job, certainly the best man in Trans-Coal Sack sector. Hardy had been 15 years a priest and 12 years a Navy chaplain, but he was only beginning to think of it as his profession. At age 35, he had been a full professor at the Imperial University on Sparta, an expert in ancient and modern human languages and the esoteric art called linguistic archaeology. Dr. David Hardy had been happy enough tracing the origins of recently discovered colonies lost for centuries. By studying their languages and their words for common objects, he could tell what part of space the original colonists had come from. Usually, he could pinpoint the planet and even the city. He liked everything about the university except the students. He had not been particularly religious until his wife was killed in a landing boat crash. Then, and he was not sure even yet how it happened, the bishop had come to see him, and Hardy had looked long and searchingly at his life and entered a seminary. His first assignment after ordination had been a disastrous tour as chaplain to students. It hadn't worked, and he could see that he was not cut out for a parish priest. The Navy needed chaplains, and could always use linguists. Now, at age 52, he sat in front of an intercom screen watching four-armed monsters playing with cabbages. A Latin crossword puzzle lay on the desk at his left hand, and Hardy played idly with it. Domine, non sum. Dignus, of course, Hardy chuckled to himself. Precisely what he had said when the cardinal gave him the assignment of accompanying the moat expedition. Lord, I am not worthy. None of us is, Hardy, the cardinal had said. But then we're not worthy of the priesthood either, and that's more presumption than going out to look at aliens. Yes, my lord. He looked at the crossword puzzle again. It was more interesting than the aliens at the moment. Rod Blaine would not have agreed, but then the captain didn't get as many chances to watch the playful little creatures as the chaplain did. There was work to do, but for now it could be neglected. His cabin intercom buzzed insistently, and the miniatures vanished to be replaced by the smooth, round face of his clerk. "Dr. Horvath insists on speaking with you." "Put him on," said Rod. As usual, Horvath's manner was a study in formal cordiality. Horvath must be getting used to getting along with men he could not allow himself to dislike. "Good morning, Captain. We have our first pictures of the alien ship. I thought you'd like to know." "Thank you, Doctor. What coding?" "They're not filed yet. I have them right here." The image split, Horvath's face on one half and a blurred shadow on the other. It was long and narrow, with one end wider than the other, and it seemed to be translucent. The narrow end terminated in a needle spine. "We caught this picture when the alien made mid-course turnover. Enlargement and noise eliminators gave us this, and we won't have better until it's alongside." Naturally, Rod thought. The alien ship would now have its drive pointed toward MacArthur. "The spine is probably the Moti fusion drive." An arrow of light sprang into the picture. "And these formations at the front end. Well, let me show you a density pattern." The density pattern showed a pencil-shaped shadow circled by a row of much wider, almost invisible toroids. "See? An inner core, rigid, used for launching. We can guess what's in there. The fusion motor, the air and water regeneration chamber for the crew. We've assumed that this section was launched via linear accelerator at high thrust. And the rings? Inflatable fuel tanks, we think. Some of them are empty now, as you can see.
They may have been kept as living space. Others were undoubtedly ditched.
Uh-huh.
Rod studied the silhouette, while Horvath watched him from the other side of the screen. Finally, Rod said, "Doctor, these tanks couldn't have been on the ship when it was launched."
"No. They may have been launched to meet the core section. Without passengers, they could have been given a much higher thrust."
"In a linear accelerator? The tanks don't look metallic."
No. They don't seem to be metallic.
The fuel has to be hydrogen, right? So how could those have been launched?"
"We don't know."
Horvath hesitated again.
"There may have been a metal core, also ditched."
All right. Thank you." After some thought, Rod put the pictures on the intercom. Nearly everything went on the intercom, which served as library, amusement center, and communications for MacArthur. In intervals between alerts or during a battle, one channel of the intercom might show anything. Canned entertainments, chess tournaments, spatball games between the champions of each watch, a play if the crew had that much time on their hands, and they did sometimes on blockade duty. The alien ship was naturally the main topic of conversation in the wardroom.
"There are shadows in yon hollow donuts," Sinclair stated, "and they move."
"Passengers, or furniture," Renner said, "which means that at least these first four sections are being used as living space. That could be a lot of Modis."
"Especially," Rod said as he entered, "if they're as crowded as that mining ship was.
Sit down, gentlemen. Carry on."
He signaled to a steward for coffee.
"One for every man aboard MacArthur," Renner said.
"Good thing we've got all this extra room, isn't it?"
Blaine winced.
Sinclair looked as if the next intercom event might star the chief engineer and the sailing master, 15 rounds.
"Sandy, what do you think of Horvath's idea?" Renner asked.
"I don't care much for his theory of launching the fuel balloons with a metal core. Wouldn't metal shells around the tanks be better? More structural support? Unless..."
"I..." Sinclair prompted. Renner said nothing.
"What is it, Renner?"
Blaine demanded.
"Never mind, sir. It was a real blue sky thought. I should learn to discipline my mind."
"Spill it, Mr. Renner."
Renner was new to the Navy, but he was learning to recognize that tone.
"Yes, sir.
It occurred to me that hydrogen is metallic at the right temperature and pressure. If those tanks were really pressurized, the hydrogen would carry a current, but it would take the kind of pressures you find at the core of a gas giant planet."
"Renner, you don't really think..."
"No, of course not, Captain. It was just a thought."
Renner's oddball idea bothered Sandy Sinclair well into the next watch. Engineer officers normally stand no watches on the bridge, but Sinclair's artificers had just finished an overhaul of the bridge life support systems, and Sinclair wanted to test them. Rather than keep another watch officer in armor while the bridge was exposed to vacuum, Sandy took the watch himself. His repairs worked perfectly, as they always did. Now, his armor stripped off, Sinclair relaxed in the command chair watching the Motis. The Moti program had tremendous popularity throughout the ship, with the tension divided between the big Moti in Crawford's stateroom and the miniatures. The big Moti had just finished rebuilding the lamp in her quarters. Now it gave a redder, more diffused light, and she was cutting away at the length of Crawford's bunk to give herself nearly a square meter of working space. Sinclair admired the Moti's work. She was deft, as sure of herself as anyone Sinclair had ever seen.
Let the scientists debate, Sandy thought. That beastie was intelligent.
On Channel 2, the miniatures played. People watched them even more than the big Moti, and Barry, watching everyone watch the little Motis, smiled to himself. Channel 2 caught Sinclair's eye, and he looked away from the big Moti, then suddenly sat bolt upright. The miniatures were having sexual intercourse.
"Get that off the intercom," Sinclair ordered.
The signal rating looked pained but switched the screen so that Channel 2 went blank.
Moments later, Renner came onto the bridge.
"What's the matter with the intercom, Sandy?" he asked.
"There is nothing wrong with the intercom," Sinclair said stiffly.